So our next two presenters who are co-presenting a paper are Joseph Bowden and Doug Piercy from the Canadian Forest Service Natural Resources Canada. So Joseph Bowden has a PhD in Natural Resources Science from McGill University and is a research scientist with Natural Resources Canada. And Doug Piercy is a geoinformatics analyst with NRCan and has an MSc and GIS certificate from the City University in London.
Hi. So as Rosa mentioned, this is Doug, a colleague of mine, and my name is Joe. We're going to talk to you today about a regional integrated assessment project that we've been working on that we've dubbed ACCESS. So what I'm going to start out doing is sort of take you through and try to summarize a previous project that was internally dubbed Forest Change 1, so where they sought to identify the impacts of climate change at a very broad scale across Canada, and then hopefully lead you into the current project, and Doug will take you through the nuts and bolts of that. So this forestry, this talk will be about forestry, but I've decided to start with an image of an iceberg. But to me, an iceberg is a very important image around climate change. It's very resonated with me. I spent a lot of time in working in Greenland before joining the CFS year and a half ago. And in Greenland, we have this giant ice sheet, about a third the size of Canada, that measures almost 3.5 kilometers thick at its center. And so we spent a lot of evenings watching and hearing calving events from this large piece of ice and these large ice cubes floating up the fjord and just cracking and eventually breaking up and exploding. And it was just like bombs going off and that echoed through the valley, and it really resonated with me. So if I'll say anything about coastal communities in this talk, it'll be that, well, there'll be some other things, but one of the big things I think we could expect increase in iceberg flows around our coastal communities. So the cliche iceberg, or the tip of the iceberg, what I would argue is that we know relatively little about climate change impacts. We're really just beginning to scratch the surface and get at the real or true implications or impacts of climate change on ecosystems. And really getting at and creating meaningful adaptation strategies and mitigation strategies or adaptation actions really seems to be quite deep down there in the abyss. So getting at those, we need to really fully understand the impacts. And so if we take a forest, this is literally a shot out of my office window in the back here. If we take a forest, this forest looks quite simple, but it's actually very complex, and there's a lot of stakeholders in this forest. So there's, you know, and I include the insects, the plants living there, the birds, the mammals, let alone all of the humans with different activities and uses of the forest. So there's a lot of personal or economic developments or interests in this forest. And then I'll end with a shot of a student of mine who swam out to an iceberg last year. So here, this GIF is just going to take you through four of those models that Marin touched on. So there's several different circulation models, but these are just four in Newfoundland that takes us up to 2100. And so we do notice that, of course, the overall trend is that we see warming. And so we see different, some of the models are more conservative than others. But we see at least something like a 3 to 4 degree increase and as much as three times our mean annual temperature that we have here in Cornerbrook, or sort of as the background 1961 to 1990. And so just another way to look at that, no matter what the model is, we do see increasing with a sort of mean, if we say model agreement, of somewhere approaching 10 degrees by 2100. So this is data from all of Newfoundland, the island. Precipitation is a little bit more cumbersome. It's really difficult to accurately project precipitation. And the province has tried this for some areas, and we do see general increases in precipitation. But if you look at precipitation data into the future, it's a lot more messy than even this temperature data. There's a lot of variation around mean projected increases. And so, again, one thing we can say is that there's going to be a lot of variation, but also very concentrated precipitation events. So we could see droughts during some parts of the season, but heavy precipitation, as we've seen this past winter, different times of the year. So taking a look at the distribution of species, so this is black spruce and balsam fir, some very important and our most dominant forest species that we have here in Newfoundland. Into the future, so if we just solely go based on where they live now and the climates they live in, and we extrapolate those climates into the future, we have this northward shift of those species. So a lot of species globally are projected to have these northward shifts in distribution based on climate, on the climate that they require to live in. So we see that black spruce is sort of gone from the island and balsam fir both. But this is totally climate driven. So that's to exclude any biological interactions. People, we're very good at modifying landscapes and managing landscapes. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that we could do to change this. So what kind of forests do we want in the future? What do we have to do to prepare for those changes and climate driven changes? So again, not surprisingly, if we have northward shifts of tree species that we have here now, we could be seeing something like a shift from what we have here now, a coniferous forest, to something more broadleaf, like white birch or maples, or as a colleague of mine said, avocados. So, I mean, we could see those kinds of shifts. So what, again, there's a lot of stakeholders. This means habitat change. This means wood supply changes. What are we producing? There's a lot of bigger implications, economic implications, social implications. So just to touch on forest disturbance, again, something that came of this synthesis in the last couple of years is that, well, with rising temperatures, we're going to see increasing forest fires. And that's largely predicted for the West Coast. And forest fire is, as I understand, thanks to a paper that Andre did actually recently, show that forest fire is not a very major disturbance, or traditionally a major disturbance here in Newfoundland. So again, we could see droughts as well, but during certain times of the year. So, and just the opposite of drought, we could see massive flooding events, as we've seen and experienced. So this is a shot from this past winter here. So a lot of changes in or effects to infrastructure, to habitats, to soils. And just to touch on insects, Liette touched on this is spruce budworm, which is a native insect pest species. Liette talked about the importance of frequency of disturbance and the amplitude of disturbance. So will we see more frequent outbreaks of insect species or bigger outbreaks of insects? It turns out that if you do some of that climate-based modeling, this guy's moving forward too. Its host species is largely balsam fir. So that moves off the island, that guy's gone too. We are an insular ecosystem. So with increased globalization, increased shipping traffic, we may see increased potential for alien invasive species. Svalbard, if you're not familiar with where Svalbard is, Google search it. It's a very, very interesting place. But Svalbard, in the last couple of years, has launched a group to monitor and track the potential for the introduction of alien invasive species in Svalbard. So that's like 79 degrees north latitude, northern Norway. So then also wind. We've experienced quite a bit of strong winds the last couple of days even here. Wind throw is one of these big phenomena here that happens on the West Coast. It's predicted that it's going to hit your pocketbook when you go to fly in the coming years. You know, stronger winds mean the higher cost of fuel to get to where you're going. Growing seasons are getting longer, as Marvin touched on. Springs are occurring earlier. We're getting warmer temperatures. This means longer growing seasons, but that doesn't necessarily translate into increased productivity. So that doesn't mean that the trees have a longer period of time to grow, that they get bigger and that sort of thing. Again, with drought and that sort of, drought, for example, during summer months, means that you're not going to be able to grow very well when it's dry. So even here in the eastern, the boreal shield east, there's a strong agreement among models to suggest that that even Newfoundland, the boreal shield east encompasses a lot of Quebec and that sort of thing. So we have to take it with a grain of salt. But even here, there's projected into the future reduction in productivity. So the boreal is a big place. The boreal forest is the largest biome on Earth. And even here in Newfoundland, we have a big part of boreal forest. And again, as Myron pointed out, what's going on and the stakeholders and the drivers the important drivers of climate and that sort of thing are not the same in the Great Northern Peninsula as they are down here. And so, and their interests, even economically, socially, are not the same across the island. So we need to think about these kinds of things when developing adaptation actions locally, because these do have to be developed at local, municipal, and regional scales. And that's one of the main things that came from Forest Change 1, is this recognition that we need a more local or regional scale development with collaboration and co-development of projects and understanding of what we need to move forward into developing specific adaptation actions to deal with some of these climate change effects. So thus came about these regional integrated assessments across Canada, of which Doug and I are co-leading here locally. All of these sites, all of the major centers of CFS across Canada are developing and encouraged to co-develop projects with local stakeholders in forestry. So that's what we're trying to do. We've been up and running for about a year now, but I'll let Doug move into the nuts and bolts of that now.
Thanks, Joe. For those that don't know, CFS Corner Brook is actually right here in this building. We live right around the corner, so we're tightly knit with Grenfell and lots of opportunities for collaborations and things there. So this is kind of our area for the ACCESS project, and of course the acronym is Assessing Climate Change in Ecological Social Systems. And our main goal is to collaboratively assess potential impacts of climate change on ecology, economics, and social issues. We've already started to identify some stakeholder groups and subject area experts, but we know there's a lot more out there, and it may include some people that are here. So should it include you? I don't know. Maybe we should discuss this at another point. We're welcome to it. Oops. So why are we doing it? Of course, this screen is different than ours in terms of size, but it's really bridging the gap between data and knowledge. So making that data available to the decision-making process. So you have to transition it in some way. So you hear a lot about value-added products. That's really what we need to get at. So our raw data has a lot of value, but if we convert that to knowledge, a lot more people can use it, and it can inform people in their decision-making process. So the area itself, you can see, is western central insular Newfoundland. We use National Hydrology Network work units to define it. They're indicated in green. The reason we chose this area is because it does contain the three main planning zones for forest activities, according to the provincial management strategies. It has Grosmore National Park. There are a mixed number of eco-districts. It's first-proof dominant, which feeds into the pulp and paper industry, which is a big part of this area. There are a number of First Nations communities, which we've already started to collaborate with, and there are a range of disturbances from insects to wind to human induced. So just from that first figure, you can see there are already a number of different values and stakeholders, but when we consider the big picture, it gets pretty complicated, and how do we really deal with all this kind of stuff? So lots of values, interactions between those values, and then impacts of change on them can get pretty complex in a hurry. So how do we get there? In the past, mainly due to technological restrictions, when you're assessing the environment, you had to deal with maybe one particular value or one issue. So they adopted a reduced processing strategy in order to get to that. Right now, I'm sure you all know, technology has really grown, and now we're able to get beyond that reduced processing strategy, and we recognize that we are dealing with a very complex system thematically, so social, economic, and ecological themes, but these also vary across time and across spatial scale. Also related to technology change, we need to move away from this black box approach. So plugging in a bunch of data and something comes out, we don't know what happens in between. We need to move towards a two-way interactive approach where we take advantage of a person's cognitive ability to assess problems and come up with solutions. The last thing, sorry, this formatting's kind of messed up a bit, but a lot of the problems that we face now do need practical solutions. So we need to move our theoretical pure research into a more applied realm that people can actually use on the ground. The theoretical pure science has great value, but unless we have people actually getting something from it and using it, really how much value does it have in the end? So the platform that we're proposing within Access has three main components. So a descriptive framework, which describes an overarching description of the different values that are there, the interactions between them, governance, the different indirect and direct drivers that would have an effect on an area. The operational framework describes the flow on how you get from your raw data into something that will contribute to a decision that has to be made. And the software, which is a suite of tools, of various tools that will allow you to accomplish or run that operational framework. So the descriptive framework that we'll be using is one that comes from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity Ecosystem Services, it's a mouthful, IPBES. Website is there if you want to learn more about it. But it did get at the key things that we think needs to be described within an environment. So at the bottom, we have our kind of intrinsic values of nature. On the left side, how these intrinsic values benefit people. And at the top, how do these benefits affect a good quality of life? And within these boxes, the green represents kind of the Western way of thinking, Western science, and blue tries to get at descriptions of these values in terms of more traditional knowledge. In the center, we've got governance or governments and basically the indirect drivers. On the right side, direct drivers could be natural, could be human-induced. Along the bottom, we've got our ranges of time, which is also critical, and interaction across spatial scales from local right up to global. The operational framework we're adopting is a geodesign framework developed by Carl Steinitz. Essentially, we're asking 6 questions within 3 iterations. So within the sort of assessment phase, we're looking at how should we describe our study area, what sort of processes happen within that study area, and is it working well according to stakeholders and users. Within the intervention phase, we're talking about how might that landscape be altered. So it could be a proposed change or it could be a predicted change, like in climate, with climate modeling. What differences might these changes cause to the values within the area? And then what decisions should be made at the end? The iterations themselves, we've got one coming down on the left side. That's basically a scoping exercise, allow you to understand what's happening in the area with a goal of getting to defining that question that needs to be answered or the problem that needs to be solved. Iteration 2 works in reverse, which is kind of weird, but if you think of it as through the scoping, we've defined the answer we need to get or the decision we need to make. What sort of things do we need to get to that point? So basically, it's the setup of the methodology of your analysis. And then iteration 3 is the actual implementation. And even though they're not indicated on this figure, there's a lot of feedback loops within that whole process. And again, if you look on the right, get back to this data knowledge transformation at both the assessment and intervention stages. So the software platform that we're developing is called Hive, which is Holistic Interactive Visualization Environment, which contains tools for data management, data processing, analysis, interactive visualization capabilities, scenario management tools, and collaboration tools. So this is all being developed using open source products, from the spatial side right to the database management, et cetera. So the next few slides I'll go through quickly, there's just some examples of the tools or processes that are going to be within that, within Hive. So mind mapping, call lots of different things, brainstorming, that sort of capability will be in there for kind of a collaborative way to quickly bring your thoughts together and try and get that focus within the scoping exercise, which is where this would be critical in that iteration 1. So allowing you to kind of get direction within that initial phase instead of going down many different roads that you may not have to go. A big part is, of course, changing values. In this example, I'll talk about visual quality. So you can really think of any sort of value model. In this case, we've got a value model that represents visual quality quantitatively and spatially. This model requires a number of different inputs, so topographic elements, elements related to hydrology, and elements related to vegetation, such as the number of different tree species disturbance. That vegetation information will come from forest inventory. As these inputs go in, they allow us to create a visual quality data set for that particular time. So how do we then see how that value changes over time? So what we'll do is simulate growth of the forest and see what impact it has. So we see we have a new future forest inventory and a future visual quality data set. The way we grow the forest, in our case, we're using a Landis-2 model, which simulates the change as a function of growth and succession. And we can incorporate different disturbances, such as harvesting, insect damage, wind, and importantly for this particular part of the project, climate change. And the way that climate change gets incorporated in this is a modification of growth curves and succession rules. So that gives us kind of one future scenario, but we really want to compare multiple scenarios. In this case, we've only got two. Again, using visual quality as an example, we've got a time zero visual quality. We look 30 years in the future using natural succession, so no management activities. Look at the change in visual quality versus using actual forest management on the ground work. Sorry, that tells me my time is up, but you get that. Anyway, I only have a couple more slides. So that allows us to compare different options. And the same would be true with climate change. If we've got four different climate change models, this would allow us to look at four different possible futures and their impacts on a value. And again, not just one value, tons of different values potentially. And probably the key piece that this software will have is the use of interactive visualizations. And this is a really good example. I got the link there. But what we have is a map, some various graphs, and some storytelling on the side, which is a big piece of visualizations these days. But as you change things within, say, the map, everything else changes as you go. So if you wanted to pick climate scenario one, things would change related to that. Climate scenario two, they change. So again, bringing in that human-computer interaction, allowing you to make inferences based on these visualizations. So transforming that data into information that can be used in your decision-making process. So just a few quick points in summary. Obviously, the values that we have and the interactions between them are quite complex. So are the impacts. In order to develop effective adaptation or mitigation strategies, we need to really have a strong understanding of what the impacts are going to be. Adaptation actions must be co-developed, so we recognize within the access program that we can't do it on our own. We don't have all the expertise in all the different subject areas. We need people to come together and contribute. We'll be modeling impacts and adaptation using multiple future forest climate scenarios within the Hive platform. And the last point is kind of key. We can model all these things to death, but unless we have a monitoring system that's keeping track of not only the adaptation strategies we've put in place, but climate itself, maybe it's not changing the way that we had modeled it. That has to be a key piece for the future. And you know how we do that, I'm not really sure, but it's got to be part of the whole process. So just some acknowledgments. We do have contributions from a number of people within our lab, but part of the core group for Access, so Joe and myself, Kate Edwards, Robert LeBlanc, and Doreen Churchill, and logos for some of the people that we've at least had preliminary discussions with for collaboration. Okay, thank you. Thank you.